Welcome to the Inside the Game podcast by Scores for Sport Management. My name is Garrett Kirsten-Thiele, and today I'm excited to be joined by Benas Matkevicius for this most recent episode of our podcast. Benas currently works for the Boston Celtics as their international scout, and he takes us into his journey through his basketball career so far, from playing in Germany and college basketball in the US, but then working his way up to the EuroLeague and then now in the NBA. It's been a great talk. The stories that Benas shares are very inspiring and show where hard work can get you. And yeah, the relationships that he's built throughout the years are amazing, and the stories that he can share. Yeah, I could listen to them for hours, so I hope you enjoy this podcast, and yeah, have fun with it. All right, today I'm excited to welcome Benas Matkevicius to the Inside the Game podcast. Benas, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for the invitation.
This is great, and I really appreciate you coming on. We've talked about this for a while, and I look forward to us chatting, because I mean, we've been in touch for a while and, you know, have known each other for a while, and just following your path has been exciting. And I do think there is a lot that people can take from your journey, from where you started to where you are now. And obviously a lot of basketball people are probably listening to this, and some of those will know you, of course. But can you give us a little bit of background about your basketball journey for those that don't know you?
Well, yeah, my journey started pretty early, because my father already was a basketball player. And when he decided to sign a contract in Germany, our family moved from Lithuania to Germany, and we started living in Westerstede, small town outside of Oldenburg. And year in, year out, my dad started to re-sign there, and that's where I first started. Also, I already was playing a little bit of basketball in Lithuania when my dad went to practices, but I had that basketball virus in my DNA early. So I carried with me everywhere I went. And actually, when we moved within Germany to another town, Cuxhaven, I was playing there as well. Played on some junior regional teams and regional select teams. And then when I was 17, I went to high school. I went to high school in the States, in Louisiana. And after that year, I came back, and I was, you know, like, it was always my dream to go to US and be there, play high school, play college. But after my first high school year, I came back, and I didn't know where I was going to be after that. So I graduated Germany. I graduated in high school in the States, and then coming back without having any clue where to go. So I went, luckily, I had a couple of good games in high school, and in that high school district, there was a college coach's son playing, and I played well those games. And the father got a job in a Division II college in Arkansas, and he noticed me in those games where it was just like sliding doors type of situation, where you just kind of like in the right place, right time, you play good games, the right person sees you. And he offered me a partial scholarship to come back the first year, just because I just that was the only offer. So I took it. I took a job on campus, and I supported myself. My parents supported me the first years, and then just earned more scholarship money, more academic scholarship money, and made my way through 4 years of college of playing Division II. Unfortunately, I had injuries there already, and then I had the dream of playing professionally, obviously, to come back into Germany. And then obviously NBA was always a dream as a player. I had never a plan B. It was only about being a player. So from there, that point on, I came back to Germany. I signed again in Cuxhaven. By that time, my dad was the coach, and he brought that team from I think Oberliga when I left to second division Germany when I came back. So that was a good place to start my career, and had a decent first year. But then the follow up injuries that led, like, from my knee went to my hips, to my back, and it was just kind of a big bad bad combination of things, and I started second year to break down. Didn't have right doctors around me to really send me into the right direction. So I had to really stop playing when I was basically 24 years old, I believe I was. So.
All right. So we're jumping in here again. Had some technical difficulties. So hopefully those are fixed now. Yeah, I think we were at the part with your second year with the Cuxhaven Baskets.
Yes. By that time, my second year, I was already making the transition from being a player to being coaching juniors, coaching, being assistant coach, just because I felt like we needed to improve our scouting in terms of analyzing the opponents. So I felt obligated to help my teammates in one way or another because I was already injured and I couldn't play. And we already signed a new player, and I was just kind of in the middle of nowhere, basically. So with that time, I added my expertise from everything that was presented to me in college, I basically turned over to the pros in terms of scouting. So that was my first step in analyzing, doing some video work, doing some scouting reports, paperwork. And I just kind of learning by doing myself early on. And then the years after that, we were really we started to become more professional as a club. It was a pleasure to work also, but the frustrations were still deep in me because I was born and I was raised to play. You know, it was just such a painful period I can remember, like until this day. And I was fighting players verbally. You know, I was yelling because I didn't see the passion in them sometimes, and I just kind of like the youth in me took over a lot of times, and it was hard to keep myself under control. And sometimes it still is because I have it in me ingrained. So like sometimes it bursts out of me, but generally I'm a mild mannered guy. But the experiences taught me different and taught me and showed me my other sides, my competitive side. And those years in Cuxhaven were pretty successful. We moved up to the first division 2 times in 3 years. And, unfortunately, the club was not financially. It was stable. It was just at that time, but it was not. It was not financially ready for the BBL. You know, we didn't want to play in the tent like Jena did during those years, just because it was just too much of a hassle, and probably would end up being wasted money. So we decided to stay in the second division. I felt stuck. I felt like I couldn't improve myself. You know, if you hit against the wall at a certain point when you just can't get can't move up like your level. You know, you want to level up essentially for the hard work, be rewarded for their hard work. But that kind of took a toll on me, and I was frustrated. I was ready to leave somewhere, and there was no job opportunities outside. Cuxhaven at that time is just kind of the market was difficult, and I was actually ready to be a personal trainer. I started to online courses. I did an online course already when I was playing also in sports marketing, but that was just to keep me occupied outside of practices. And then when I was coaching, I started a personal trainer course just because I had a passion for that as well. But then luckily out of the blue, Cesca called whichever way you want to take it. It was the coach was Lithuanian, and my dad used to play with him in the early 80s in Lithuania, and he needed a scout. He needed somebody he could trust. Mm-hmm. And he brought me over there to give me a chance basically to finish up the season. You know, I left during the middle, during the end like March, April of a Pro A season to join the Cesca in 2011. And that was very, very ingrainful experience. It was really, really mind-changing, basically. Because until that time, I grew up in small towns always, Westerstede, Cuxhaven, small college town in Arkansas. Like Louisiana, Shreveport was a little bit bigger, but the surroundings were pretty limited, pretty small. You know, like the society I was around, the people that I was around was very close knit, always a family environment. And then you go to Moscow, and it's a life changing experience. I My car got broken into my first week there, just because I was so naive and lost my laptop, lost everything. Luckily, J.R. Holden, who everybody should know, had a friend coming from the U.S. at that time, the same week, and he brought me a new laptop. So it was like one thing after another early on. I didn't know Russian at that time, but I learned as the time went on. Mm-hmm. We had a interesting following year with CSKA, where with Kirilenko joining the club later on during the lockout, and it was a very successful season. I was doing advanced scouting work for that year. I was doing the scouting reports on the road while I was scouting the opponents, EuroLeague opponents, writing down the plays, the play calls, you know, trying to catch all the play calls from the opposing teams and complete the playbook and the scouting report and send it out to the assistant coach for it to be translated to Russian as well, because we gave the scouting reports in Russian and English. So the Russians had it in Russian, the international players had it in English, and I was basically working remotely and living in Moscow, but traveling probably half the time on the road ahead of the team. You know, if we play Barcelona next week, in 2 weeks, I'm next week in Barcelona, and then I just kind of always ahead of the road, and sometimes I joined CSKA at home games. Mm-hmm. And it was a very interesting period. That was my first time I started to travel that much, you know, just like it was, you know, hotel. It was basically what I do now. It's just different. You're doing it for a team. I think I was the only advanced scout in EuroLeague that consistently, because there was no other team that could probably afford that kind of luxury. And we were successful. Just unfortunately, the infamous final against Olympiakos in Istanbul. I was already on the bench at that time. Because towards the end of the season, I joined the bench and I was able to see everything up close, because I knew all the play calls, so I could help the team with preparing for the defensive side, you know, to be prepared for the players to be prepared not to get stuck on screens and things like that. So from that point on, after that unsuccessful final, the coaching change came to CSKA and Messina arrived. Mm-hmm. And they opted to keep me, but my role would change. I would be more on the court. I would be more on the staff. No traveling. There was no scouts for Messina. It was only all assistant coaches. Everybody was equal, and it was, you know, Quinn Snyder's year in Russia. So I had the honor to work with Quinn Snyder, and also the year before, honestly, who taught me the right ways was Yanis Varopoulos, who coaches at Maccabi now. Mm-hmm. He was the assistant coach the year before that, and he showed me the ways to really be organized. And with Quinn the following year, because you spend most of the time with assistant coaches, you know, like the head coaches in and out, and we do have meetings, but you spend most of the time with the assistant coaches discussing, talking, getting to know each other. The relationships are strong. So, because you have to trust each other as a staff,
right?
And with Quinn, we spent a lot of time in the office discussing. Quinn is a mastermind, because his brain never stops working. It was the first time I saw a person like that. It was just one day he would come in the office and say, "Hey, Benas, what do you think about this?" And he would just write up the whiteboard full of pick and roll coverages. You know, like this pick and roll this way. We defend this pick and roll that way, and then the next day would come in, and in 5 minutes he would chalk up the whole whiteboard in like different pick and roll options, you know, just like draw up a full series of plays. I mean, it was amazing to watch, and it was one of the periods where I kind of went into a new dimension, because Quinn taught me to think outside the box. Basically, there was very, very creative work, were very creative options on offense, and basically we had this. I'm going into detail now, so you can stop me.
Well, you know, I think this is already great. Maybe some stuff for later. So CSKA, this is already like some of the stuff that impressed you after CSKA 2014. What happens there? I think that's a big one for a lot of people too.
Yeah. Okay. That after CSKA, after 2 years with Messina, we Boston presented themselves to me already, actually before that, because I already met the scouts there, the responsible people at the Celtics at the Eurocamp a couple of years before that. And the year in 2014, when there's a new change again at CSKA, the Celtics ended up offering me a 3-year contract to do scouting work for them in Europe. And right. For me, it was a different kind of dimension. Again, it was a different experience, different job completely. Honestly, I didn't know how much different it will be, but it was, to me, the Boston Celtics brand was the most intriguing part about it. And it was very, you know, to work with the legendary franchise and learn from the best was something that I couldn't pass up, you know. And right. Nevertheless, I still love CSKA. We still are in touch, and we still have good, you know, good memories that we share all the time. But it was at that time, at that point in my life, and with that situation, I listened to my heart at that time, and it was sort of like, you know, change of scenery, change of job, change of, you know, league, obviously, and going to the highest level possible in the basketball world. So that took me outside of a team bubble into the world bubble, because I was used to living in the team environment, roster, you know, like from one roster to another. You have the people around that are very, very like, you bond relationships, you know, you build relationships and you go from there. And it just, like, I'm still in touch with some players from back in those days, just because it's such a, you have a knack for each other. You have something to share. But now I was by myself, and I went to Barcelona to live, because I felt like after 3 years of snow and ice, I needed some sunshine.
Yeah.
So I chose, because with this job, you have the freedom to choose where you want to live, as long as there's an airport. And I chose Barcelona. The wrong part of Barcelona that I chose out to live outside, and I just could only spend 3 to 4 months. And everything was just, without going into detail, everything didn't work out that well for me personally there. Plus, I was in the hole because I didn't have a team around me. You know, I was lost, basically. I'd turn on the TV and I watch FC Barcelona play against CSKA. I'm watching my guys on TV, and it felt so weird. You know, it was like what is this? Like, what am I doing? You know. So, but it, from that point on, it just kind of, like, that was a really, really important life lesson for me as well. It opened up a different, you know, facing anxiety, facing some fears, and opening up a new dimension within you.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point on, just kind of like, I decided to move back to Lithuania. I have my friends around, and I lived there for a year and a half, and for 3 more years. Then now here I am, you know, going to this is the end of the year, basically. That was the scouting part. Those were my full-time jobs. But parallel, in 2014, if we go back, actually 2013, sorry. We go back to line it up with the rest of my career until this point, was the national team of Lithuania, yeah, where the national team coach was the CSKA coach who brought me to CSKA. It was the coach Kozlauskas who brought me to CSKA, and he was the one who opened the doors for me, because he trusted me already to be the scout of the national team. So the first years, I was also the video coordinator and video and scout at the national team level, where the 2013 and 2015 successes were my fondest memories, you know, for those years. And it was very, very much something that I will never forget, because it was, you know, two silver medals in 4 years with Kozlauskas were the highest achievement that one could imagine, only losing to Spain and to France in 2013, to Spain in 2015, and then the Olympics in 2016 were a little bit underachieving. That's, you know, you couldn't ask for more. I mean, in 2014 in Spain at the World Cup, we were fourth place, losing to France again for the bronze medal. Then the coaching change came to the national team, and the coach decided to keep me as an assistant on the staff. So I lived through Adomaitis' career with the national team, and now with Mascalunas taking over, he also wanted to keep me on the staff just because I've been around for so long and we worked together. Mascalunas was actually the assistant coach when Kozlowskis was the head coach. So he knew me already. He knew what he could get from me, and my experience was valuable to him. So here I am, still the assistant coach of the national team and still a scout with the Celtics. So it's been best of both worlds, basically, presented to me in a nutshell.
You know, I mean, just listening to you speak about all of this, and at 36 years old, you're still young. All the stuff that you've already experienced, the people you have met, I mean, there are so many amazing stories in that.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for people in Europe that decide to make basketball their job in whatever capacity that is, I think it's amazing to hear you talk about that and your journey there. And when you started out, you said you didn't have a plan B. For you, it was about basketball, and you know, making it to the NBA as a player was a dream. Being where you are now, when did that thought of, or was it a goal of yours to also work in the NBA once you knew it wasn't going to be as a player? But was it a goal for you to say, I want to get there? Or was that just something that kind of happened through all the experiences, through all the things that you have done? Was it just like a step that happened, or was it like a dream, a goal of yours?
It was never a dream. It was never a goal. It was a dream to play there, but it was never a goal of me, of mine, to work in the NBA. I just, like, the way I live life, and I live it to this day, and I believe in it wholeheartedly because it got me this far, and I will continue to live that way in this kind of mindset and philosophy, is do your job as best as you can, because it will prepare you for something that you might not know exists, you know, like, and when the door opens that you don't expect to open, you will be ready just because you prepared yourself in the steps prior to that. So I was always, because I was so frustrated when I had to stop playing, I dove into the coaching aspect. I was trying to somehow contribute. I was doing the scouting reports. I was preparing myself without knowing for my next steps. And then when the CSKA job arrived out of nowhere, like, who would dream of being going to CSKA from Pro A Germany to CSKA? I mean, it's not impossible, but it's very, very unlikely. And, you know, like, I was scared. I'm not going to lie. I was scared of going there and not knowing that I don't know enough, you know, but I do want to learn. I believe in personal growth. I believe in professional growth. And I believed in the process that I didn't skip steps along the way to get there. Obviously, I skipped a whole bunch of stories, like in terms of level 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 from Pro A to EuroLeague level. But I was ready to learn and to catch up, because I had the habits built in me. You know, I had the habits of working, and those habits followed me to Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
Even without knowing the language, I started to learn the language, to understand the culture better, to understand the players better, to be able to connect. And, you know, when I first got there, everything was three times as fast as it was in Pro A. To me, everything was just the decision making, the execution, the brains that were flying around. You know, I was just listening to conversations. I was talking to Trajan Langdon after practice to see, why is he holding the ball on his seams? How does he catch the ball on his seams? How does he roll? Like, I was noticing things that I never noticed before, and I had the treasure or the blessing to ask these questions close up. So I was just eager, and I was not afraid to fail. I was not afraid to ask the questions, because I never believed in hiding your weaknesses. I think it's a strength to show that you don't know something. I think it's a strength to be able to stand up and be able to admit to mistakes, because it's something that we all do. So those things kind of were what followed me. I did mistakes and I got better through that. And you know, it never got to a point where I was gonna like fail, like not fail, but would get kicked out or anything. But it was something mm-hmm. that I was afraid. Obviously, the next day, because law school was very tough on me. So I was like, there was days at nights where I went to bed. And I was like, man, he's gonna fire me tomorrow, man. I was so scared to go into the office the next day. I was like, oh man, he's gonna kick me out. So, but then you wake up and you wake up in the morning and you go back to the office and you stand straight up. You tighten yourself up, and you try again and you try again. And that's one thing that I kind of felt like I was as a player. You know, when you get knocked down, you get back up. If you miss a shot, you go back on defense, you take a charge or things like that. So it's something that it carries over. And that took me also, like, that kind of helped me to build a reputation around the EuroLeague, around the clubs that I knew, the people that I knew. And the world travels. And at some point, with the Celtics, I met Austin Ainge in Poland during the under 18 championships when Schroeder was there playing. I believe it was the summer of 2012, okay. I believe. I think 2012. Yeah. So that was again a sliding door situation. I was sitting there without a Cska shirt. I believe I was just sitting there, and he was there. And he just introduced himself to me because he saw I was taking notes. And I was just kind of like, we're not going to, like, Cska's not going to sign, unlikely to sign an 18-year-old, 17-year-old prospect from Spain or from, but it was something that I wanted to do for the future of Cska. And Austin saw me there sitting, and we connected. He just introduced himself to me. I would never know who he is, you know, at that, without, you know, like, I didn't know anybody at that time, basically, but we stayed in touch from that point on, and we went, you know, like, our separate ways, but we always helped each other with certain information about players, about players in Russia, players that in the NBA that were interesting to us, maybe, you know. So it's just kind of the network start building, the relationships start building. And then at some point, the point arrived where they offered me a full-time position. And, you know, and that was never a goal of mine, honestly. When I was, mm-hmm. people think these days that when you're in touch with somebody, that there's an agenda, you know, like there's, like, I don't want ever to send like the wrong message that I have an agenda. I'm fine how I am. I'm fine right. knowing you or not knowing you. I'm just in there for, maybe I can learn something from you. Maybe you can teach me something. Maybe I can give you something useful. I think it's all about helping each other and using the network in the right ways. And from that point, it will, you know, like, doors will open up automatically if you just do your job that you're supposed to do right now without thinking a step ahead. Because people make the mistake to think too far ahead, and they just kind of looking, they're one foot in the door, inside the room, 1 foot outside the room already, you know, and want to already move on to the next spot. And I don't think that's the right way to do. You always have to respect the process and do your job that you're supposed to do, and then other things will open up. So there's never an agenda for me. There never was an agenda. And these things just start happening just because they felt confident in me and I felt confident in myself. So you know, although I didn't know this world existed the way I got to know it in the last 6 years, because the Celtics experience was not only a basketball experience, it was also a life experience. So I can go into that if you like, or if you would.
Sure,
like.
let's do that. What I really think is interesting to hear, and I think a lot of people can draw from that. And you said it earlier. Not every favor, not every helpful act needs to lead to something right now, exactly. But it can in the future. And being diligent with your work and how you go about it, just hearing you talk about your career as a player, your way into college basketball, I think a lot of players these days would just say, well, if I don't get a full ride, I'm not going to do it. You worked for it. You wanted something. You worked for it and you did your part. You know, you didn't ask for handouts. And I think that speaks to your work ethic now and how you go about it. And, and, And I think that's great. And I think it's something that a lot of people can draw from. And, you know, obviously I have some questions or thoughts here, but just hearing you talk and the process, how you went about your work and how those relationships were built is amazing. Through your work with Cheska or the Boston Celtics, is there anything or any person that stands out in regards to what impressed you work ethic wise? You already talked about Quinn Snyder a little bit. Is there something there where you think that totally stood out and impressed you?
Go back again, like just to be clear, in college, I was really. It was a partial scholarship my first year, and then like you said I had to work for it, but it was truly a challenge because it may have sounded like it was easy, you know, I just took a part-time job and you don't have to, like, as an athlete you don't have to work as hard. I felt the responsibility and the accountability to the people who helped me to get a job, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had a partial scholarship, but then I also had to go to I don't know if people know what intramural sports is. It's a sports league within the college environment on the campus for the students that are not athletes, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was there renting out basketballs. I was refereeing flag football, which I had to learn the rules as I go because I never had, like, flag football.
Right.
And then I had a student ambassador job that also paid a part of my books, you know, gave me a little bit of extra money also to live off. So
yeah, so we're fixing some other technical difficulties again, and hopefully this works now. So you were just talking about, you know, what that job was really like. And, you know, I think some people would think that it's like getting a handout and you really don't have to do anything, but you know, working to make things work is something that a lot of people underestimate.
Yes, and just to go back to my college times that you've mentioned before, it's something that when you get an opportunity, you feel accountable for the people and you feel responsible towards the people that help you get the job. So when I came to college without a full ride, without the full scholarship, but I had to look for getting a job and earning some money on the side to support myself, to support my tuition. And that was when I worked a job at intramurals, you know, like the for people who don't know, it's a sports league within the campus for the non scholarship athletes, for the non-athletes that are not playing any kind of sports school. So I was there renting out balls, refereeing flag football, which I had no idea about. I had no clue about flag football. I was just the guy that was just learning the ways as he went again. I was also having ambassador job on campus where I could show new students that come, or potential students from high school, to show them around on campus to make them feel comfortable and be a good representative of the school, to show them the ways of how we live on campus. And that paid me some extra money, some extra small scholarship on the side that helped me to, again, support myself in any kind of way. And sometimes I had to stay a summer to take a summer job to support myself with, you know, for my car that I eventually bought. I stayed and worked for one of our uncles for my host family in the States all summer painting a dock and helping build a house. That paid me a good amount of money to help me buy a car. And it was something that you have to do in order to desperate people do desperate things, and desperate people that want to achieve things, they don't care of what it takes, you know. It built my character for later. Like, kind of iron sharpens iron. Like, you get to the point to the tough point by getting through the tough times, and then that's where you can take it to the next level. And when I was in Moscow, I was already you know, ready to work the way I always worked. And those people that hired me, they saw that I was eager to learn, I was eager to work, I was eager to learn something new. But I also felt responsible towards them. Kozlauskas brought me. If I fail, that means Kozlauskas failed, you know, like that means he he signed the wrong person. So I felt not the pressure, of course, like the pressure to succeed, but also the accountability, you know, towards another person. Mm-hmm. And that was genuine work that you put in, and the people around you see it. So the second season with Kozlauskas, where we had this phenomenal season, Sviropoulos was the assistant coach, and he was the one who showed me a phenomenal standard of work. He saw that I was trying and working hard, and although I had still lots to learn, he showed me the right ways. And he was the most organized person that I've ever met. And he was kind of like, he has a military background. Mm-hmm. And he also was working at PAOK in the late 90s and early 2000s as an assistant. And he was, you know, Kozlauskas got him and kept him throughout this whole time, also at Olympiakos, at the Greek national team. And he knew who he was getting because he was the most organized assistant coach you can have. And I was seeing him every day. If you ask him what we did in practice, or what he did in practice, let's say in PAOK in 2002 in November 30th, he will bring out a folder and show you the practice. You know, that's the type of person he is. So he showed me the ways, and I'm not to his standards by any means. Like, I couldn't do the same thing. I try, but that was the first example I can give you. Then with Quinn, the following year, it was a completely different personality, first of all, but also a completely different way of working, completely different brain wiring, because his creativity and his kind of the way the spontaneous way of working, I would say, was very important to see, where he taught me to think outside the box. And mm-hmm. he saw that I was very much into the X's and O's. We love to exchange ideas on how to make certain options work and how to make ATOs. And I was drawing up my ATOs to give to Messina. And I was that was the reality of things for me, because he didn't have to use it, but it looks like a really, really interesting option for our roster, for our five that we have on the floor at that time. And Quinn taught me that, you know, Quinn taught me to think that way. We had a transition offense that was really creative and free flow, and it was kind of the first free flow offense type of transition in Europe. And if you go back during those years, you could tell that we had Teodosic and Kyriapa, which uh-huh. were probably the smartest players that you can have on the EuroLeague, in the EuroLeague, playing a pick and pop together early on in the transition. And you start with that, you know, you start the transition with that. And out of that, you have, we created a whole bunch of different options. Like, without going much into detail, because it's hard to describe what right. I talk, but it was a very eye-opening experience, because before that it was very structured, you know, because Lauskas was a different type of coach, where it was very systematic and very strict, without many opportunities to break out of the offense. And with Quinn and with Messina, like, yes, you expect it to be also systematic, but with the transition offense, we gave him a lot of pull, we gave him a long leash, you know, and then we worked with that in practice. We worked all the options, and it changed my wiring in my brain for sure. It changed the way I approached the whole game. I saw that the way I saw the game, and that from that point on, it was kind of like, man, this you can live your all your fantasies on the basketball court, basically, you know. Like, I didn't know that those things are possible, and so it was really exciting, to say the least. So from there, when we continued to work, then next year, Quinn went back to the States to be Atlanta Hawks assistant coach, and Dan Shamir came, who's now in New Zealand. And that was another brain that was very interesting to work with, and lots of different. I admired his ability to connect to players, the way he talked to the players, and the way he found his ways to build relationships. I thought that was very interesting as well. So you can kind of draw something from every coach you work with, you know, and that was like very, very, versatile, a variety of experiences I experienced within that short span in Moscow, you know.
Yeah.
Just speaking on the court without even going about off the court experiences. Yeah.
Well, I mean, all the names you mentioned, the people that you've worked with, I mean, those are all, you know, people who are successful with everything they're doing now. And you know, this for you goes back to 2014 or earlier. So just following or kind of tracking down where the people are that you just mentioned and what they have been doing since, I can only imagine how many more interesting stories are in there. Now you work for the Boston Celtics. You work with them as an international scout. What is that process like when you evaluate talent, whether that's prior to the draft or you're looking at a lot of guys that are playing overseas in general? What's the process there? What do you look for when you look at players, when you look at talent?
Yeah, with the Celtics, it taught me again a different approach to everything. Before, it was very much deadline oriented, you know, like the coaching and the preparation for the scouting reports and the team preparation was like every 3 days you have a game. So you basically have to be ahead of the curve, you know, and you have to always be prepared like every 3 days to hand in your scouting report, the video, be ready to work in practice. And then with the Celtics, it was, you know, the draft is in June. So like I was too eager early on, and it was kind of like, you know, like this is the job description is different. It's a process. You have to observe the process of players. You have to observe the ability to improve of a player, the things that they do on the court, and what, you know, you have to follow the information of what they're doing off the court. You know, if it's very if it's a special situation, you kind of pick up special things through your network, special information that you probably wouldn't read about online. So I think the most important thing I learned is the network. And through that network, you can find or get to the information you need. And when I watch a player, I basically divide it in two categories just to keep it simple. Like I do draft category and free agent category. And along the way, also summer league category, you know, like two-way or G League categories, but those are free agents that I count, and that's just a different subcategory in that department. But when I look during the pre-draft process, starting early in the season, the scouting year is a long year, and it just, you know, the traveling picks up in end of September, beginning of October. And I try to knock out a lot of the traveling early the first part of the year so I can spend the second part of the year watching a lot of video, watching college and watching workouts or working from home and gathering intel. So the first part of the season when I watch the players, the young players, which we want to focus on now, it's basically to see, first of all, if they have the physical tools. Because in Europe, and if you don't watch a lot of college games, college players live, and you watch only Europe, you're pretty much biased towards one part of the medal, you know, like one side, and you have to be able to compare the two. So that's why my trips to the States are also essential, 3 times a year to find out and to compare the players I saw with the college players. And the physical tools, the foot speed, the length, the reach of players, you know, how athletic are they? And that's the initial part. Like you kind of see what kind of position they can play, who could they be able to defend, who would they be able to defend. And the most difficult part is where will they be in 4 years, let's say. You know, like that's like to project is the most difficult part of this process, because you're getting where you used to get in a draft, you used to get, you know, 21, 22-year-olds finishing college or maybe after the junior year. That was a surprise back in the 90s, you know, but or early 2000s, let's say. And now you're getting freshmen that come in and there are 19, you know, like you're trying to see where the 19-year-old is going to be in as a 22, 23-year-old. And that's basically a very, very well educated guess, I would say. You have to, that's why all the information that you gather throughout the year, the intel process about the background, about the work ethic and the general mental makeup of the player, of how committed he is to his game, of how committed he is to his process, and also if he's able to understand schemes, how his IQ is, how is his ability to learn, how is he as a teammate. So you're trying to go through the whole process of him, imagining him making it to the next level, and not only getting there but also staying there is the key. You don't want to draft somebody who's just not gonna stay for a longer period. You want somebody that can stick and that you have the rights to, and you hopefully he can help you franchise. And the other players that you observe, you kind of, you know, throughout the year, obviously the you know, you look for the feel of the game, if they have the ability to adapt themselves and find their role on the team. A lot of times I feel, if I want to jump to the pros, a lot of times I feel that the roles they play in Europe at the highest level, not always, or like they cannot always transfer to the NBA. You have to find something that can fit in on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. So,
right. Yeah.
It's a really high level role player in EuroLeague has, if he brings the tools, if he has the right, you know, physical tools and the talent to play in the NBA, it's probably easier to adapt to the same role in the NBA, just because he's been playing that role and he will feel more comfortable with that role. You cannot bring a role player and make him a star in the NBA, obviously. Like, that's very, very rare, but you can it's even harder to adjust from being a superstar in EuroLeague to go to the NBA and then not being able to be that kind of superstar, but maybe having to adjust to being a role player and changing your mindset, you know, to certain points. So sometimes those things can have bring a player down and he cannot show and portray his talent on the highest stage, so he would never feel comfortable there. So it's you have to really pin it down to what your team needs and what you can find in the player. Maybe there's a player that's more talented, but he's not going to fit your team or what you need. So you don't, even though he could play in the NBA, but he may not be the best fit for your team, you know. So you have to kind of put everything in perspective, and then making the right decision in the end is probably the most difficult part, because you just it's a really, you know, always risky to sign somebody, but you always have to before you make that decision, you have to be absolutely confident in the decision, and once it gets there, you're basically committed to it. So that's why the whole process is important.
Well, there is a lot of money on the line when you make decisions, yes, whether that's in the draft or through free agency. You guys, without going into any names, but with the Boston Celtics, you have been able to incorporate and add players from Europe through free agency as well. What is that process like, or how can people imagine that when you get to those decisions? How difficult is it to convince the front office in the US about a player, or how does that process work? How can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, it's not, you know, like this year we probably had the most free agents on the roster that have played in Europe before and were successful at their respective levels. So it's always a long process. It's not just 1 year. It's always several seasons in a row where you kind of following the player and you see how he's adapting. You kind of get a feel for his mentality and how he is, his impact on the floor. And you know, like then at the end of that process, you certainly have an opinion about him and his impact that he can bring to the team. But along the way, you always present that, and you remind, like in my case, I have to, like, we send messages to each other all the time. We're always on WhatsApp, or we're always on email chains that we really exchange information and send out certain descriptions or statistics of certain achievements of certain players, and we try to get a common consensus at the end. Not everybody has the same opinion about the player because they have different perspectives. So we all have to justify our perspective and our point of view. You know, like the context is very important. Every situation at a different club is different. You know, every club has a different kind of situation for the player that may or may not work for that player at that time. So he may be looking worse than he is. Or he may be looking better than he is. You know, that's another, like, it's always, you have to know the politics and the context of each club that you're looking at. So I think the context is very important. And we do exchange it during the year. I make my opinion heard. And when we discuss, we kind of try to get on the same page with all our perspectives and try to build, see how the player can fit on our roster. So it's a bundle of things. It's a email chain, it's a WhatsApp information, it's phone calls, it's discussions, and it's meetings when I'm there that we compare players and do some video work to show and to point out the strengths and weaknesses of the player that if they're going to show on the NBA floor, because the NBA spacing is completely different. And in Europe, you may be more protected on defense. In the NBA, you're probably more exposed, you know, in that aspect. So you have to put everything, compare the two a lot of times, and you have to find the things that will help you the most. And you have, at the end, and that was a key point that my boss made to me. At the key point, you certainly have to know which weaknesses you can live with. You know, like, no, there's no player that has absolutely everything and has no weakness. I mean, there's always a weakness to be found, and you basically have to decide which weakness is, like, you can compensate the most.
And when you look at younger talent, you said that the big part of it is projecting what could that player potentially be, and kind of finding out what work ethic he has, and getting that information from your network, basically, and getting more background info. What kind of role do mock drafts play for you in your work? What do they mean for you?
Early on in my scout career, I looked at them a lot, and just to have the names and to get an idea of what's what I should be looking at. Maybe, you know, mm-hmm. maybe I should be looking at something closer than I am. But in the recent years, I went away from that, just because at the end, mock drafts are also subjective. You know, it's very hard to make a very sound mock draft that you, like, everybody agrees on, because it's, you look at them and they're all over the place from one person to another. And I try to stay away, not to be influenced by it, and build my own opinion, mm-hmm. and have a clear opinion of the players I'm looking at, knowing what's in the pool of the players I have to look at. And then at the end, sometimes I do look at it to see where the opinions could differ, you know, and then you kind of revisit the players and you see if, you know, maybe you change your opinion, or you change a little bit of your perspective through that. But I'm very cautious with that, because it can be influential. It can impact your brain, and you want to go away from groupthink. You don't want to have everybody having the same opinion, having the same idea about the draft. You want everybody having different kind of perspectives and different point of views to be able to compare and argue against each other. So the mock drafts are just they're there, but to me personally they're not as important in my decision making. They're just there for me to see which names are being maybe overvalued or undervalued, and it's interesting to me to really dig deeper once I realize that there's a discrepancy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they help to sometimes see who else is, you know, who did somebody see, who's on the radar, where, and then to make sure you don't miss somebody. I think that can play a role. I mean,
yeah,
you travel so much, you're on the road all the time in different places, and obviously you see a lot of players. How do you stay, with you being on the road, how do you make sure you stay fit, or how do you get your mind away from basketball while living in this basketball bubble so much?
Yeah, that's a very important point. That's probably the most important factor in having a successful path, I think, is to find a balance. And early on, it was very difficult for me early on, just because I didn't know any other way. But the more I work, the more I feel, and I feel it's more effective if you find a way to get away. And you work hard when you work, but then you also have to, you know, relax or get away from it in your kind of way. Not everybody relaxes the same way. I personally like to stay active. I like to work out. I like to stay in shape. I like to look out for my nutrition when I travel. And when I don't travel, I look at nutrition generally, just because I think it's a very important factor of our lives and our health and immune system. I'm valuing sleep a lot, not oversleeping, but in terms of getting a consistent sleep schedule. Mm-hmm. I think science has proven, and science has shown, that those three factors are the most important thing to keep us, keep our minds sharp, you know, working out, nutrition, and sleep. So I think those three things are key factors in my general way of living. So I try to balance all those things out, and then, you know, trying to get away, I just try to stay active any kind of way. I try, when I go to the cities, to the respective cities on my road trips, I tend to go and go look up some good, nice cafes, because I have a passion for coffee. Right. So yep. I try to find, and I get a kick out of it when guys text me, my colleagues from other teams text me and ask me if there's a good cafe somewhere, and I'm able to send them to a nice cafe where they can enjoy their coffee. And I have spots in every city, basically, that I feel like that's where I can hang my hat on. You know, like, my coffee game is off the charts, I can say.
Well, I know I made use of that in Porto, so
yes. I'm glad. So I try that. I get a kick out of that, and I occupy my brain in different ways. I try to stay on my toes, relaxing when I relax a little bit, but also gathering new information, or just reading certain things, interesting things that are going on around the world, and something I can learn from. But it's important to get away from basketball in general, just to get back to it and feel fresh about it. You know, it's never healthy to completely absorb yourself 110% into something. Other people have families and they have a balance that way. You know, it's probably a natural way of finding a little bit more balance with your loved ones. Mm-hmm. But as long as I don't have a family, I find other things to do. I don't get bored. You know, I find other things that make me happy and get my mind of day-to-day things, because in this job there is no routine, there is no one schedule. Like, you have to be flexible. I get messages on random times from random people that you don't expect to get from, you know, and then you have to be able to help that person, or they help you. And if, you know, like, if you write them and they're not answering your message right away, which is expected, you know, you can't expect everybody to answer you right away. So maybe they answer you 2-3 hours from now, and you have to be able to react that time and adjust, you know, adapt mm-hmm. to that schedule. So you always have to be on your toes in this job and be flexible and be able to adapt to different situations. I think that's why you have to have a sharp mind. That's when the balance comes into play.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest things to do. A lot of people say when you work in basketball, you can kind of, whether that's as an agent, as a scout, as a coach, as a player, a lot of people say, well, you could, you're lucky you made your hobby at some point, or your passion, you made that your job. But that can also make it difficult to get away from it at some point, you know, and then that's what I've been noticing. And while I love this game and you know, it's fun, it also takes something away from you. And I think that's something where we all have to make sure we get our time away to not lose our love for it, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You like, for sure, I catch myself also sometimes you're watching, like you're going from one game to another. Sometimes there's junior tournaments and you watch six games in one day, sometimes seven. I mean, it gets to a point where it's ridiculous, you know, and you there's no human mind alive. I cannot say that can, like, they would lie that if they see every game, every minute of every game full time, because at some point your mind drifts off, you know. You have to change the scenery, you have to kind of, you know, change up the routine a little bit, break it up and somehow stay fresh, because otherwise you just will not see, like the German saying, or I think there's English saying as well, du siehst den Wald vor lauter Bäumen nicht mehr. So this is too many trees, and you don't see the forest anymore, you know.
That's
so
right.
That's how you can feel sometimes when you get absorbed with it.
Yeah, but I think we all love basketball, and we couldn't do what we are doing the way we're doing it if we didn't enjoy it. So Benaz, I'm very thankful for your time, all the insight about, you know, your route, your way in the game of basketball, and thank you for sharing all of that. And I know I could do this again and go more in depth about some of those stories that I know you have from all these great people that you've worked with. So thank you for your time today, like I said.
No, thanks for having me. I enjoy to reminisce and think back a little bit. And if it helps some people, or if, like, I feel a need to help sometimes, and or most of the time actually. So I'm just glad I can share some of the stories, some of my point of views, and I'm always open for any kind of conversations like that. So feel free.
Great. Well, I look forward to seeing you in an arena. Hopefully sometime soon after we get basketball back as we know it.
Yes, me too.
Right.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right, thanks for listening to this episode of our Inside the Game podcast. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Benaz Matkevicius. Like I said, going in, I could listen to him for hours and, you know, hear his stories about the people that he met along his way. And I'm definitely hoping to be able to get him on again and talk in depth about some of those stories and just to learn more from him. And again, I hope you enjoyed it, and hope you will come back. Would be great to get feedback from you, people that you would like to hear from. And maybe we can get some of those on the show. So thanks for listening. Have a great day.